promoting scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite.
We've signed a climate convention on the importance of economic instruments and free markets. We're included in this mammoth Agenda 21 document and the Rio Declaration. Now, let me be clear on one fundamental point. The United States fully intends to be the world's preeminent leader in protecting the global environment.
Coming up, Technocracy News. And greetings once again from Technocracy News and Trends. Patrick Wood here, Editor-in-Chief, and today is July 26, 2019. It's amazing that some people can actually go to technocracy.news, read something there, and conclude that this is a website that's favorable towards anything to do with radical environmentalism or the Green New Deal or some aspect of climate change. And that's only because they don't read the comments that I put at the top of each article, and I hope you all do. Because the reason I put in articles by other people all around the world that are writing from the other side's point of view, I want people to read it with their own eyes and to understand it exactly like they spit it out. This is the whole point of it. I could probably write articles all day long myself describing what I read in these other articles, but that's not the same as you reading it yourself. So the first article, for instance, today, Green New Deal, Affordable Housing, and Climate Change, has nothing to do with me promoting the Green New Deal, affordable housing, or climate change, anyone. But in this article, there are just several things that stand out that should send off alarm bells for anybody that reads it. And of course, those who are predisposed to the Green New Deal and so on, they read this kind of article and go, oh yeah, that's for us. This article starts out by saying there is a broad consensus among the international scientific community that the need to address climate change is dire. I want to point out first here that there is no broad consensus among the international scientific community. It's absolutely not true. A few scientists have produced reports, true, over the years, that have said that climate change is real, especially man-made climate change is a real thing. But for every scientist that has said that climate change is caused by man, there's been just as many on the other side that said, no, it's not. How you can conclude that that is a broad consensus is beyond me. It simply is not. The article goes on, the United Nations has set an urgent deadline of 2030 to implement global emission policies, warning that a perilous rise in global temperature will occur if they are not met. Well, it's true that the United Nations has set a deadline, claimed that it was urgent, and claimed that if their demands are not met, that global temperatures are going to rise and basically cook everyone. The article continues, the advocacy group Greater Washington and the D.C. Democratic Socialist of America organized a panel of academic and policy experts to identify how the district could meet those goals while also addressing its struggles with an affordable housing crisis and increased inequality. Quote, environmentalists know transportation is the elephant in the room, Alex Baca, the housing program organizer for Greater Washington, wrote in an article for Slate. He continued, at first blush, the easiest way to attack that problem is to electrify everything. And that's largely what the Green New Deal calls for. Time out. Electrifying everything will simply raise the cost of everything. Every place that alternative energy has been introduced has raised utility bills for everybody in the district. That's a fact, documentable. Baca, a panelist, doesn't think technology can remedy the consequences of urban sprawl. The missing piece of the story, he argued, is housing policy. Here we go. Other concerns, like food and job security, are generally prioritized over the serious environmental impact of a long drive to work that might otherwise be viewed as only an inconvenience, according to Baca. But D.C., with the second longest average commute in the U.S., is chock full of carbon-emitting motorists. Land use is really hard to talk about, right? Said Baca. Who is really talking about why the house they grew up in is where it is? The smart growth perspective Baca endorses is founded on the premise that increasing density in urban areas will reduce transportation costs and create jobs close to where people live, thus reducing their carbon footprint. But densification alone may not be enough. According to panelists and University of Pennsylvania sociology professor Daniel Cohen, what the country needs is 10 million new public no-carbon homes in 10 years. He says densification without aggressive interventions to ensure affordability simply isn't going to work. Well, I will suggest, Mr. Cohen, that densification, in addition to alternative energy, will do nothing but raise the prices and frustrate people to death. This will not solve any problem that you say you're trying to solve. These people are thinking in a different way completely than a calm, level-headed person ought to think. They're completely bought into the idea that they have to act because climate change is going to catch them, it's going to burn them to death, or it's going to drown them if the oceans rise, and they can't do all this stuff fast enough. But one thing this article does bring up is a connection of smart growth to Green New Deal and climate change. Smart growth is the trigger word for sustainable development in America. There is no doubt that the Green New Deal is just nothing more than sustainable development on steroids. Well, so much for the Green New Deal. The next story is titled, Private Surveillance is Not Off Limits to Law Enforcement. Now, here is a sobering thought. Some cities are outlawing surveillance of one type or another, especially facial recognition, and in some cases, license plate readers. But private neighborhood watch projects are allowed to buy this kind of technology and use it, and there's no regulation whatsoever on them. Now, a city council certainly could outlaw that for private citizens as well, but they have not done so yet. And the bottom line of this story is, even if a city says police departments and other law enforcement agencies cannot use this type of technology, private citizens can and are, and in almost every instance, the data collected by those private systems is available to law enforcement when they demand it. So this may be one potential way for them to completely get around any regulations that the city tries to put on them. This article starts out, residents of major American cities are constantly watched by ubiquitous cameras, mushrooming license plate readers, and a battery of new smart city sensors. But, it writes, it's not just the government keeping tabs. An explosion of private surveillance set up by businesses, landlords, and neighbors is driven by increasingly cheap but powerful technology, and what these observers see could make its way back to law enforcement. That's the truth of the matter. That's already happening as well. So anywhere that there's pockets of data, if it can be discovered by law enforcement, they will be after it. The trouble is, in this case, you can't hide yourself from it or complain to a private citizen because he has a license plate reader on his property reading license plates of cars that drive by. It doesn't quite sound right, does it? But that's the way it is. Well, that's one more consideration. If you go to your city council and you ask them to get rid of some of this technology, make sure that they also outlaw it for private citizens. The last story is undoubtedly the most disturbing story today. It's written by John W. Whitehead. John is a constitutional attorney and author, and he's also the founder and president of the Venerable Rutherford Institute. It's been around for years and years. John's been around for years and years, too, and has had a lot to say about the constitutional nature of America, how it's changed, etc. This article that he presented here recently on his website, which is reprinted on technocracy.news, the title is The Tyranny of the Police State Disguised as Law and Order. And this indeed is a disturbing article. My comments on it are, as police departments are further militarized and as training is increasingly degraded, overactions and overreactions are common, and atrocities against innocent citizens are seen more frequently across the nation. And you all know stories from your own communities, probably, where this is the case, where somebody's home gets broken into by mistake, The family gets terrorized in the middle of the night by a SWAT team barging in, possibly breaking down the door, scaring the homeowners to death, only to find out, oops, got the wrong house. Sorry, lady. Sorry, sir. Sorry, kids. It's just over the top. John is very passionate about this, and I can't blame him. I am too. His article starts out with a quote that states, "But these weren't the kind of monsters that had tentacles and rotting skin, the kind a 70-year-old might be able to wrap his mind around. They were monsters with human faces and crisp uniforms, marching in lockstep. So banal you don't recognize them for what they are until it's too late." That's from Ransom Riggs, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. "Enough already," John writes. "Enough with the distractions. Enough with partisan jousting. Enough with the sniping and name-calling and mudslinging that do nothing to make this country safer or freer or more just. We have let the government's evil doing, its abuses, power grabs, brutality, meanness, inhumanity, immorality, greed, corruption, debauchery, and tyranny go on for far too long. We are approaching a reckoning. This is the point, as the poet W.B. Yeats warned, when things fall apart and anarchy is loosed upon the world. We have seen this convergence before in Hitler's Germany and Stalin's Russia and Mussolini's Italy and Mao's China. The rise of strongmen and demagogues, the ascendancy of profit-driven politics over deep-seated principles, the warring nationalism that seeks to divide and conquer, the callous disregard for basic human rights and dignity, and the silence of people who should know better. Yet no matter how many times the world has been down this road before, we can't seem to avoid repeating the deadly mistakes of the past. This is not just playing out in a national and international scale. It is wreaking havoc at the most immediate level as well, creating rifts and polarities within families and friends, neighborhoods and communities that keep the populace warring among themselves and incapable of presenting a united front in the face of the government's goose-stepping despotism. We are definitely in desperate need of a populace that can stand up united against the government's authoritarian tendencies. Surely, we can manage to find some common ground in the midst of the destructive, disruptive, diverting, discordant babble being beamed down at us by the powers that be. After all, these are certain self-evident truths about the source of our freedom, about the purpose of government, about how we expect to be treated by those we appoint to service in government offices, about what to do when the government abuses our rights and our trust, etc., that we should be able to agree on, no matter how we might differ politically. Disagree all you want about health care, abortion, and immigration, hot-button issues that are guaranteed to stir up the masses, secure campaign contributions, and turn political discourse into a circus free-for-all, but never forget that our power as a citizenry comes from the ability to agree and stand united on certain principles that should be non-negotiable. For instance, for the first time in the nation's history, it is expected that the federal deficit will surpass $1 trillion this year, not to mention the national debt, which is approaching $23 trillion. There's also $21 trillion in government spending that cannot be accounted for or explained. For those in need of a quick reminder, a budget deficit is the difference between what the government takes in and what is spent. The national debt is the result of the federal government borrowing money to cover years and years of budget deficits. Right now, the U.S. government is operating in the negative on every front, is spending far more than what it makes and takes from American taxpayers, and it is borrowing heavily from foreign governments and Social Security to keep the government operating and keep funding its endless wars abroad. Meanwhile, the nation's sorely neglected infrastructure, that is railroads, water pipelines, ports, dams, bridges, airports, and roads, is rapidly deteriorating. Yet no matter how we might differ about how the government allocates its spending, surely we can agree that the government's irresponsible spending, which has saddled us with insurmountable debt, is pushing the country to the edge of financial and physical ruin. That's just one example of many that shows the extent to which the agents of American police state are shredding the constitutional fabric of our nation, eclipsing the rights of American people, and perverting basic standards of decency. Let me give you a few more, he writes. Having been co-opted by greedy defense contractors, corrupt politicians, and incompetent government officials, America's expanding military empire is bleeding the country dry at the rate of more than $15 billion a month. That's $20 million per hour. And that's just what the government spends on foreign wars. The U.S. military empire's determination to police the rest of the world has resulted in more than 1.3 million U.S. troops being stationed at roughly 1,000 military bases in over 150 countries around the world. That doesn't include the number of private contractors pulling in hefty salaries at taxpayer expense. In Afghanistan, for instance, private contractors outnumber U.S. troops there 3-1. No matter how we might differ about the role of the U.S. military in foreign affairs, surely we can agree that America's war spending and commitment to policing the rest of the world are bankrupting the nation and spreading our troops dangerously thin. He continues that theme through the article, which I will not read, but I encourage you to go and read it word for word. He says, yet no matter how we differ about how the success or failure of past or present presidential administrations, surely we can agree that the president should not be empowered to act as an imperial dictator with permanent powers. No matter how we might differ about where to draw the blue line of allegiance to the police state, surely we can agree that police shouldn't go around terrorizing and shooting innocent, unarmed children and adults or be absolved of wrongdoing for doing so. No matter how we might differ about where to draw the line when it comes to prisoners' rights, surely we can agree that no one, woman, man, or child, should be subjected to such degrading treatment in the name of law and order. No matter how we might differ about the deference due to those in uniform, whether military or law enforcement, surely we can agree that America's founders had good reason to warn about the menace of a national police force, aka a standing army, vested with the power to completely disregard the Constitution. No matter how we might differ about the extent to which the government has final say in how it flexes its power and exerts its authority, surely we can agree that the tyranny of the nanny state, disguised as the greater good, marked as benevolent, enforced with armed police, and inflicted on all those who do not belong to the elite ruling class and that gets to call the shots, should not be allowed to pave over the Constitution. This is an important article. It might seem radical at first to you. It might seem a little overly critical at first to you. This is an important article to read. The militarization of police in America is shocking if you remember back, say, 20 years ago to what the state of modern policing was then. Today, every law enforcement department, including many government agencies as well, have their own dedicated SWAT teams that are heavily armed, in some cases as much as the U.S. military. They're a scary presence, and in some cases, cities have actually purchased Army surplus material like personnel carriers, armored carriers, tanks in some cases, grenade launchers, you name it. And training that's been given to police now over the last few years is increasingly militaristic training, not peacekeeping training, but militaristic training. This has changed the mission of most law enforcement agencies in America. There have been many articles recently, and at least in the last couple of years, that have pointed out, in legitimate peer-reviewed studies, I might add, that the militarization of the police in America has not resulted in a reduction of crime at all. So you ask, well, what's the point? Why militarize the police if it doesn't drive down crime? Well, that's a good question. Our founding fathers were very clear that America was not to have a standing army inside our borders that would be used to police our own people. They were adamant about that, and there was good reason for that, because if there is a standing army and it answers to the commander-in-chief, that standing army can be used as a weapon from the top down to control the people in society. This is something we simply do not want. It's not a question of affording it. This is something we just flat out do not want, and police forces across America are all looking the same now. You see pictures, you see the gear that they have, you see stories of their exploits, if you will, and you just shake your head and say, is that really necessary, either to use that level of force or to use that level of equipment to catch a common criminal? You know, there was a day when police work was halfway civil, where detectives did their work to find out where the criminal is, the perpetrator, arrest him discreetly, snatch him out of society, put handcuffs on them, put them in a police car, and away you go. Not today. Today, you're more likely to see a SWAT team show up in an armored vehicle with 15 people rolling out the back with ARs and batons and shields and riot helmets and everything else, battering rams. Instead of having one officer go in and arrest somebody, you have a whole SWAT team who ends up making a huge statement to the community. Wow, look how organized we are. Look how tough we are. Well, many articles have said also along the way, just examining this, that the public's perception of the police has changed radically over the last 10 years. And this is specifically why. Because they're not peacekeepers anymore. They're not trying to keep peace in the community. They're trying to deliver a show of force that intimidates people. Well, that's a sad state of affairs. I encourage you to go and read John Whitehead's article. If you have a mind to buy his book, check it out. John's a serious guy. He's a good thinker. Been around for a long time. And he basically really does know what he's talking about. So everybody has a lot of work to do in their own community. Get a hold of your mayor, your city council. Start talking with them about this. Saying, guys, we need to go back to being law enforcement, perhaps. But we need to go back to being peacekeepers. That's what our job is all about. We're called peace officers, not combat officers. Well, I'm Patrick Wood for Technocracy News and Trends. Catch you next week.